Well, having just been round Europe with Ian, we're off again a bit later with Aileen Manahan-Thomas. She's here to introduce a concert recorded in Frankfurt. It was given by the city's Radio Symphony Orchestra, who devoted the occasion to music by Purcell, Sammartini, Handel and Vivaldi. That's all in Early Music Late, which starts tonight at about 5 to 10. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. How to have a good death. In 1776, the atheist David Hume was dying, and he addressed it in his essay My Own Life. In 2015, Oliver Sacks wrote his My Own Life, encouraged by the words of Hume. Tonight's Drama on Three is a reading of both pieces, alongside pieces by Hume, by James Boswell and Adam Smith.
My Own Life. From the writings of Oliver Sacks, David Hume, James Boswell, and Adam Smith. The New York Times, February 19th, 2015. My Own Life, by Oliver Sacks.
A month ago, I felt that I was in good health, even robust health. At 81, I still swim a mile a day, but my luck has run out. A few weeks ago, I learned that I have multiple metastases in the liver. 9 years ago, it was discovered that I had a rare tumour of the eye, an ocular melanoma. The radiation and lasering to remove the tumour ultimately left me blind in that eye. But though ocular melanomas metastasize in perhaps 50% of cases, given the particulars of my own case, the likelihood was much smaller. I am among the unlucky ones. I am grateful that I have been granted 9 years of good health and productivity since the original diagnosis. But now, I am face to face with dying. The cancer occupies a third of my liver, and though its advance may be slowed, this particular sort of cancer cannot be halted. It is up to me now to choose how to live out the months that remain to me. I have to live in the richest, deepest, most productive way I can. In this, I am encouraged by the words of one of my favourite philosophers, David Hume, who, upon learning that he was mortally ill at age 65, wrote a short autobiography in a single day in April of 1776. He titled it My Own Life.
It is difficult for a man to speak long of himself without vanity. Therefore, I shall be short. It may be thought an instance of vanity that I pretend at all to write my life, but this narrative shall contain little more than the history of my writings, as indeed almost all my life has been spent in literary pursuits and occupations. The first success of most of my writings was not such as to be an object of vanity. I was born the 26th of April, 1711, old style, at Edinburgh. I was of a good family, both by father and mother. My father's family is a branch of the Earl of Humes, and my ancestors had been proprietors of the estate, which my brother possesses, for several generations. My mother was daughter of Sir David Faulkner, president of the College of Justice. The title of Lord Halkerton came by succession to her brother. My family, however, was not rich, and being myself a younger brother, my patrimony, according to the mode of my country, was of course very slender. My father, who passed for a man of parts, died when I was an infant, leaving me with an elder brother and a sister under the care of our mother, a woman of singular merit, who, though young and handsome, devoted herself entirely to the rearing and educating of her children. I passed through the ordinary course of education with success, and was seized very early with a passion for literature, which has been the ruling passion of my life and the great source of my enjoyments. My studious disposition, my sobriety, and my industry gave my family a notion that the law was a proper profession for me, but I found an insurmountable aversion to everything but the pursuits of philosophy and general learning. And while they fancied I was poring over Vogt and Vinnius, Cicero and Virgil were the authors which I was secretly devouring. My very slender fortune, however, being unsuitable to this plan of life, and my health being a little broken by my ardent application, I was tempted, or rather forced, to make a very feeble trial for entering into a more active scene of life. In 1734 I went to Bristol with some recommendations to eminent merchants, but in a few months found that scene totally unsuitable to me. I went over to France with a view of prosecuting my studies in a country retreat, and I there laid that plan of life which I have steadily and successfully pursued. I resolved to make a very rigid frugality supply my deficiency of fortune, to maintain unimpaired my independency, and to regard every object as contemptible, except the improvement of my talents in literature. During my retreat in France, first at Arras, but chiefly at La Flèche in Anjou, I composed my Treatise of Human Nature. After passing 3 years very agreeably in that country, I came over to London in 1737. In the end of 1738, I published my treatise and immediately went down to my mother and my brother, who lived at his country house and was employing himself very judiciously and successfully in the improvement of his fortune. Never literary attempt was more unfortunate than my Treatise of Human Nature. It fell dead-born from the press, without reaching such distinction as even to excite a murmur among the zealots. But being naturally of a cheerful and sanguine temper, I very soon recovered the blow, and prosecuted with great ardour my studies in the country. In 1742, I printed at Edinburgh the first part of my essays. The work was favourably received, and soon made me entirely forget my former disappointment. I continued with my mother and brother in the country, and in that time recovered the knowledge of the Greek language, which I had too much neglected in my early youth. In 1745, I received a letter from the Marquis of Annandale, inviting me to come and live with him in England. I found also that the friends and family of that young nobleman were desirous of putting him under my care and direction, for the state of his mind and health required it. I lived with him 12 months. My appointments during that time made a considerable accession to my small fortune. I then received an invitation from General Sinclair to attend him as a secretary to his expedition, which was at first meant against Canada, but ended up in an incursion on the coast of France. Next year, to wit, 1747, I received an invitation from the General to attend him in the same station in his military embassy to the courts of Vienna and Turin. These 2 years were almost the only interruptions which my studies had received during the course of my life. I passed them agreeably and in good company, and my appointments with my frugality had made me reach a fortune, which I called independent, though most of my friends were inclined to smile when I said so. In short, I was now master of near £1,000. I had always entertained a notion that my want of success in publishing the Treatise of Human Nature had proceeded more from the manner than the matter, and that I had been guilty of a very usual indiscretion in going to the press too early. I therefore cast the first part of that work anew in the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, which was published while I was in Turin. But this piece was at first little more successful than the Treatise of Human Nature. On my return from Italy, I had the mortification to find all England in a ferment on account of Dr. Middleton's free inquiry, while my performance was entirely overlooked and neglected. A new edition, which had been published at London, of my essays, Moral and Political, met not with a much better reception. Such is the force of natural temper that these disappointments made little or no impression on me. I went down in 1749 and lived 2 years with my brother at his country house, for my mother was now dead. I there composed the second part of my essays, which I called Political Discourses, and also my inquiry concerning the principles of morals, which is another part of my treatise that I cast anew. Meanwhile, my bookseller, A. Miller, informed me that my former publications, all but the unfortunate treatise, were beginning to be the subject of conversation, that the sale of them was gradually increasing, and that new editions were demanded. Answers by reverends and right reverends came out 2 or 3 in a year, and I found, by Dr. Warburton's railing, that the books were beginning to be esteemed in good company. However, I had fixed a resolution, which I inflexibly maintained, never to reply to anybody, and not being very irascible in my temper, I have easily kept myself clear of all literary squabbles. These symptoms of a rising reputation gave me encouragement, as I was ever more disposed to see the favourable than unfavourable side of things, a turn of mind which it is more happy to possess than to be born to an estate of 10,000 a year. In 1751, I removed from the country to the town, the true scene for a man of letters. In 1752, were published at Edinburgh, where I then lived, my Political Discourses, the only work of mine that was successful on the first publication. In the same year was published at London my Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, which, in my own opinion, who ought not to judge on that subject, is of all my writings, historical, philosophical, or literary, incomparably the best. It came unnoticed and unobserved into the world. In 1752, the Faculty of Advocates chose me their librarian, an office from which I received little or no emolument, but which gave me the command of a large library. I then formed the plan of writing the history of England. But being frightened with the notion of continuing a narrative through a period of 1700 years, I commenced with the accession of the House of Stuart, an epoch when, I thought, the misrepresentations of faction began chiefly to take place. I was, I own, sanguine in my expectations of the success of this work. I thought that I was the only historian that had at once neglected present power, interest, and authority, and the cry of popular prejudices, and as the subject was suited to every capacity, I expected proportional applause. But miserable was my disappointment. I was assailed by one cry of reproach, disapprobation, and even detestation. English, Scotch, and Irish, Whig and Tory, churchman and sectary, free thinker and religionist, patriot and courtier, united in their rage against the man who had presumed to shed a generous tear for the fate of Charles I and the Earl of Strafford. And after the first ebullitions of their fury was over, what was still more mortifying, the book seemed to sink into oblivion. Mr. Miller told me that in a 12-month he sold only 45 copies of it. I scarcely indeed heard of one man in 3 kingdoms considerable for rank or letters that could endure the book. I must only accept the Primate of England, Dr. Herring, and the Primate of Ireland, Dr. Stone, which seem 2 odd exceptions. These dignified prelates separately sent me messages not to be discouraged. I was, however, I confess, discouraged, and had not the war been at that time breaking out between France and England, I had certainly retired to some provincial town of the former kingdom, have changed my name, and never more have returned to my native country. But as this scheme was not now practicable, and the subsequent volume was considerably advanced, I resolved to pick up courage and to persevere. In this interval, I published at London my Natural History of Religion, along with some other small pieces. Its public entry was rather obscure, except only that Dr. Hurd wrote a pamphlet against it, with all the illiberal petulance, arrogance, and scurrility which distinguished the Warburtonian school. This pamphlet gave me some consolation for the otherwise indifferent reception of my performance. In 1756, 2 years after the fall of the first volume, was published the second volume of my history, containing the period from the death of Charles I to the Revolution. This performance happened to give less displeasure to the Whigs, and was better received. It not only rose itself, but helped to buoy up its unfortunate brother. But though I had been taught by experience that the Whig party were in possession of bestowing all places, both in the state and in literature, I was so little inclined to yield to their senseless clamour that in above 100 alterations, which further study, reading, or reflection engaged me to make in the reigns of the two first Stuarts, I have made all of them invariably to the Tory side. It is ridiculous to consider the English Constitution before that period as a regular plan of liberty. In 1759, I published my History of the House of Tudor. The clamour against this performance was almost equal to that against the history of the two first Stuarts. The reign of Elizabeth was particularly obnoxious, but I was now callous against the impressions of public folly, and continued very peaceably and contentedly in my retreat at Edinburgh to finish, in two volumes, the more early part of the English history, which I gave to the public in 1761, with tolerable and but tolerable success. But notwithstanding this variety of winds and seasons to which my writings had been exposed, they had still been making such advances that the copy money given me by the booksellers much exceeded anything formerly known in England. I was become not only independent, but opulent. I retired to my native country of Scotland, determined never more to set my foot out of it, and retaining the satisfaction of never having preferred a request to one great man, or even of making advances of friendship to any of them. As I was now turned of 50, I thought of passing all the rest of my life in this philosophical manner, when I received, in 1763, an invitation from the Earl of Hertford, with whom I was not in the least acquainted, to attend him on his embassy to Paris, with a near prospect of being appointed secretary to the embassy, and, in the meanwhile, of performing the functions of that office. This offer, however inviting, I at first declined, both because I was reluctant to begin connections with the great, and because I was afraid that the civilities and gay company of Paris would prove disagreeable to a person of my age and humour. But on his lordship's repeating the invitation, I accepted it. I have every reason, both of pleasure and interest, to think myself happy in my connections with that nobleman, as well as afterwards with his brother, General Conway. Those who have not seen the strange effects of modes will never imagine the reception I met with at Paris from men and women of all ranks and stations. The more I resiled from their excessive civilities, the more I was loaded with them. There is, however, a real satisfaction in living at Paris, from the great number of sensible, knowing, and polite company with which that city abounds above all places in the universe. I thought once of settling there for life. In the beginning of 1766, I left Paris, and next summer went to Edinburgh with the same view as formerly of burying myself in a philosophical retreat. I returned to that place not richer, but with much more money and a much larger income by means of Lord Hertford's friendship than I left it. And I was desirous of trying what superfluity could produce, as I had formerly made an experiment of competency. But in 1767, I received from Mr. Conway an invitation to be under-secretary, and this invitation, both the character of the person and my connections with Lord Hertford, prevented me from declining. I returned to Edinburgh in 1769, very opulent, for I possessed a revenue of £1,000 a year. Healthy, and though somewhat stricken in years, with the prospect of enjoying long my ease and of seeing the increase of my reputation. In spring 1775, I was struck with a disorder in my bowels, which at first gave me no alarm, but has since, as I apprehended, become mortal and incurable. I now reckon upon a speedy dissolution. I've suffered very little pain from my disorder, and what is more strange, have, notwithstanding the great decline of my person, never suffered a moment's abatement of my spirits. Insomuch that, were I to name the period of my life which I should most choose to pass over again, I might be tempted to point to this later period. I possess the same ardour as ever in study, and the same gaiety in company. I consider, besides, that a man of 65, by dying, cuts off only a few years of infirmities, and though I see many symptoms of my literary reputation breaking out at last with additional lustre, I knew that I could have had but few years to enjoy it. It is difficult to be more detached from life than I am at present. To conclude historically with my own character, I am, or rather was, for that is the style I must now use in speaking of myself, which emboldens me the more to speak my sentiments. I was, I say, a man of mild dispositions, of command of temper, of an open, social, and cheerful humour, capable of attachment, but little susceptible to enmity, and of great moderation in all my passions. Even my love of literary fame, my ruling passion, never soured my temper, notwithstanding my frequent disappointments. My company was not unacceptable to the young and the careless, as well as to the studious and literary. And as I took a particular pleasure in the company of modest women, I had no reason to be displeased with the reception I met with from them. In a word, though most men, anywise eminent, have found reason to complain of calumny, I never was touched, or even attacked, by her baleful tooth. And though I wantonly exposed myself to the rage of both civil and religious factions, they seemed to be disarmed in my behalf of their wonted fury. My friends never had occasion to vindicate any one circumstance of my character and conduct. Not but that the zealots, we may well suppose, would have been glad to invent and propagate any story to my disadvantage, but they could never find any which they thought would wear the face of probability. I cannot say there is no vanity in making this funeral oration of myself, but I hope it is not a misplaced one, and this is a matter of fact which is easily cleared and ascertained.
An account of my last interview with David Hume, Esquire, partly recorded in my journal, partly enlarged from my memory. by James Boswell. On Sunday, forenoon the 7th of July, 1776, being too late for church, I went to see Mr. David Hume, who was returned from London and Bath, just a-dying. I found him alone, in a reclining posture in his drawing room. He was lean, ghastly, and quite of an earthy appearance. He was dressed in a suit of grey cloth with white metal buttons, and a kind of scratch wig. He was quite different from the plump figure which he used to present. He had before him Dr. Campbell's Philosophy of Rhetoric. He seemed to be placid and even cheerful. He said he was just approaching to his end. I think these were his words. I know not how I contrived to get the subject of immortality introduced. He said he never had entertained any belief in religion since he began to read Locke and Clarke. I asked him if he was not religious when he was young. He said he was, and he used to read The Whole Duty of Man, that he made an abstract from the catalogue of vices at the end of it and examined himself by this, leaving out murder and theft and such vices as he had no chance of committing, having no inclination to commit them. This, he said, was strange work. For instance, to try if, notwithstanding his excelling as schoolfellows, he had no pride or vanity. He smiled in ridicule of this as absurd and contrary to fixed principles and necessary consequences, not adverting that religious discipline does not mean to extinguish but to moderate the passions. Certainly an excess of pride or vanity is dangerous and generally hurtful. He then said flatly that the morality of every religion was bad, and I really thought was not jocular when he said that when he heard a man was religious, he concluded he was a rascal, though he had known some instances of very good men being religious. This was just an extravagant reverse of the common remark as to infidels. I had a strong curiosity to be satisfied if he persisted in disbelieving a future state even when he had death before his eyes. I was persuaded from what he now said, and from his manner of saying it, that he did persist. I asked him if it was not possible that there might be a future state. He answered it was possible that a piece of coal put upon the fire would not burn. And he added that it was a most unreasonable fancy that we should exist forever, that immortality, if it were at all, must be general, that a great proportion of the human race has hardly any intellectual qualities, that a great proportion dies in infancy before being possessed of reason, yet all these must be immortal, that a porter who gets drunk by 10 o'clock with gin must be immortal, that the trash of every age must be preserved, and that new universes must be created to contain such infinite numbers. This appeared to me an unphilosophical objection, and I said, Mr. Hume, you know spirit does not take up space. I asked if the thought of annihilation never gave him any uneasiness. He said, not the least, no more than the thought that he had not been, as Lucretius observes. Well, said I, Mr. Hume, I hope to triumph over you when I meet you in the future state, and remember, you're not to pretend that you was joking with all this infidelity. Oh, no, no, said he, but I shall have been so long there before you come that it will be nothing new. In this style of good humour and levity did I conduct the conversation. Perhaps it was wrong on so awful a subject, but as nobody was present, I thought it could have no bad effect. I, however, felt a degree of horror, mixed with a sort of wild, strange, hurrying recollection of my excellent mother's pious instructions, of Dr. Johnson's noble lessons, and of my religious sentiments and affections during the course of my life. I was like a man in sudden danger, eagerly seeking his defensive arms. And I could not but be assailed by momentary doubts, while I had actually before me a man of such strong abilities and extensive inquiry dying in the persuasion of being annihilated. But I maintained my faith. I told him that I believed the Christian religion as I believed history. Said he, You do not believe it as you believe the revolution. Yes, said I, but the difference is that I am not so much interested in the truth of the revolution. Otherwise I should have anxious doubts concerning it. A man who is in love has doubts of the affection of his mistress, without cause. He had once said to me, on a forenoon while the sun was shining bright, that he did not wish to be immortal. This was a most wonderful thought. The reason he gave was that he was very well in this state of being, and that the chances were very much against his being so well in another state, and he would rather not be more than worse. I answered that it was reasonable to hope he would be better, that there would be a progressive improvement. I tried him at this interview with that topic, saying that a future state was surely a pleasing idea. He said no, for that it was always seen through a gloomy medium. There was always a phlegathon or a hell. But, said I, would it not be agreeable to have hopes of seeing our friends again? And I mentioned three men lately deceased, for whom I knew he had a high value, Ambassador Keith, Lord Alamour, and Baron Muir. He owned it would be agreeable, but added that none of them entertained such a notion. I believe he said such a foolish or such an absurd notion, for he was indecently and impolitely positive in incredulity. I somehow or other brought Dr. Johnson's name into our conversation. I'd often heard him speak of that great man in a very illiberal manner. He said upon this occasion, Johnson should be pleased with my history. Nettled by Hume's frequent attacks upon my revered friend in former conversations, I told him now that Dr. Johnson did not allow him much credit, for he said, Sir, the fellow is a Tory by chance. I'm sorry that I mentioned this at such a time. I was off my guard. For the truth is that Mr. Hume's pleasantry was such that there was no solemnity in the scene, and death, for the time, did not seem dismal. It surprised me to find him talking of different matters with a tranquillity of mind and a clearness of head which few men possess at any time. Two particulars I remember. Smith's Wealth of Nations, which he commended much, and Monboddo's Origin of Language, which he treated contemptuously. I said, if I were you, I should regret annihilation. Had I written such an admirable history, I should be sorry to leave it. He said, I shall leave that history, of which you are pleased to speak so favourably, as perfect as I can. He said, too, that all the great abilities with which men had ever been endowed were relative to this world. He said he became a greater friend to the Stuart family as he advanced in studying for his history, and he hoped he had vindicated the two first of them so effectually that they would never again be attacked. Mr. Lauder, his surgeon, came in for a little, and Mr. Muir, the Baron's son, for another small interval. He was, as far as I could judge, quite easy with both. He said he had no pain, but was wasting away. I left him with impressions which disturbed me for some time.
Hume wrote, I now reckon upon a speedy dissolution. I have suffered very little pain from my disorder, and what is more strange, have, notwithstanding the great decline of my person, never suffered a moment's abatement of my spirits. I possess the same ardour as ever in study, and the same gaiety in company. I have been lucky enough to live past 80, and the 15 years allotted to me beyond Hume's 65 have been equally rich in work and love. In that time, I have published 5 books and completed an autobiography, rather longer than Hume's few pages, to be published this spring. I have several other books nearly finished. Hume continued, I am a man of mild dispositions, of command of temper, of an open, social, and cheerful humour. Capable of attachment, but little susceptible of enmity, and of great moderation in all my passions. Well, here I depart from Hume. While I have enjoyed loving relationships and friendships and have no real enemies, I cannot say, nor would anyone who knows me say, that I am a man of mild dispositions. On the contrary, I am a man of vehement disposition, with violent enthusiasms and extreme immoderation in all my passions. And yet, one line from Hume's essay strikes me as especially true. It is difficult, he wrote, to be more detached from life than I am at present.
Kirkcaldy, Fifeshire, November the 9th, 1776. Dear Sir, it is with a real, though a very melancholy pleasure that I sit down to give you some account of the behaviour of our late excellent friend, Mr. Hume, during his last illness. Though, in his own judgment, his disease was mortal and incurable, yet he allowed himself to be prevailed upon by the entreaty of his friends to try what might be the effects of a long journey. A few days before he set out, he wrote that account of his own life, which, together with his other papers, he has left to your care. My account, therefore, shall begin where his ends. He set out for London towards the end of April, and at Morpeth met Mr. John Hume and myself, who had both come down from London on purpose to see him, expecting to have found him in Edinburgh. Mr. Hume returned with him, and attended him during the whole of his stay in England, with that care and attention which might be expected from a temper so perfectly friendly and affectionate. As I had written to my mother that she might expect me in Scotland, I was under the necessity of continuing my journey. His disease seemed to yield to exercise and change of air, and when he arrived in London, he was apparently in much better health than when he left Edinburgh. He was advised to go to Bath to drink the waters, which appeared for some time to have so good an effect upon him that even he himself began to entertain, what he was not apt to do, a better opinion of his own health. His symptoms, however, soon returned with their usual violence, and from that moment he gave up all thoughts of recovery, but submitted with the utmost cheerfulness and the most perfect complacency and resignation. Upon his return to Edinburgh, though he found himself much weaker, yet his cheerfulness never abated, and he continued to divert himself as usual with correcting his own works for a new edition, with reading books of amusement, with the conversation of his friends, and sometimes in the evening with a party at his favourite game of whist. His cheerfulness was so great, and his conversation and amusements run so much in their usual strain, that, notwithstanding all the bad symptoms, many people could not believe he was dying. "I shall tell your friend Colonel Edmonston," said Dr. Dundas to him one day, "that I left you much better and in a fair way of recovery." "Doctor," he said, "as I believe you would not choose to tell anything but the truth, you had better tell him that I am dying as fast as my enemies, if I have any, could wish, and as easily and cheerfully as my best friends could desire." Colonel Edmonston soon afterwards came to see him and take leave of him, and on his way home he could not forbear writing to him a letter bidding him once more an eternal adieu. Mr. Hume's magnanimity and firmness were such that his most affectionate friends knew they hazarded nothing in talking or writing to him as to a dying man, and that so far from being hurt by this frankness, he was rather pleased and flattered by it. I happened to come into his room while he was reading this letter, which he had just received, and which he immediately showed me. I told him that though I was sensible how very much he was weakened, and that appearances were in many respects very bad, yet his cheerfulness was still so great, the spirit of life seemed still to be so very strong in him, that I could not help entertaining some faint hopes. He answered, "Your hopes are groundless. An habitual diarrhea of more than a year standing would be a very bad disease at any age. At my age, it is a mortal one. When I lie down in the evening, I feel myself weaker than when I rose in the morning, and when I rise in the morning, weaker than when I lay down in the evening. I am sensible, besides, that some of my vital parts are affected, so that I must soon die." "Well," I said, "if it must be so, you at least have the satisfaction of leaving all your friends, your brother's family in particular, in great prosperity." He said that he felt that satisfaction so sensibly that when he was reading, a few days before, Lucian's Dialogues of the Dead, among all the excuses which are alleged to Charon for not entering readily into his boat, he could not find one that fitted him. He had no house to finish, he had no daughter to provide for, he had no enemies upon whom he wished to revenge himself. "I could not well imagine," said he, "what excuse I could make in order to obtain a little delay. I have done everything of consequence which I ever meant to do, and I could at no time expect to leave my relations and friends in a better situation than that in which I am now likely to leave them. I, therefore, have all reason to die contented." He then diverted himself with inventing several jocular excuses, which he supposed he might make to Charon, and with imagining the very surly answers which it might suit the character of Charon to return to them. "Upon further consideration," said he, "I thought I might say to him, 'Good Charon, I have been correcting my works for a new edition. Allow me a little time that I may see how the public receives the alterations.' But Charon would answer, 'When you have seen the effect of these, you will be for making other alterations. There will be no end of such excuses. So, honest friend, please step into the boat.' But I might still urge, 'Have a little patience, good Charon. I have been endeavouring to open the eyes of the public. If I live a few years longer, I may have the satisfaction of seeing the downfall of some of the prevailing systems of superstition.' But Charon would then lose all temper and decency. 'You loitering rogue! That will not happen these many hundred years. Do you fancy I will grant you a lease for so long a term? Get in the boat this instant, you lazy, loitering rogue!'" But though Mr. Hume always talked of his approaching dissolution with great cheerfulness, he never affected to make any parade of his magnanimity. He never mentioned the subject but when the conversation naturally led to it, and never dwelt longer upon it than the course of the conversation happened to require. It was a subject, indeed, which occurred pretty frequently, in consequence of the inquiries which his friends who came to see him naturally made concerning his state of health. The conversation which I mention above, and which passed on Thursday the 8th of August, was the last, except one, that I ever had with him. He had now become so very weak that the company of his most intimate friends fatigued him. For his cheerfulness was still so great, his complaisance and his social disposition were still so entire, that when any friend was with him, he could not help talking more, and with greater exertion than suited the weakness of his body. At his own desire, therefore, I agreed to leave Edinburgh, where I was staying partly upon his account, and return to my mother's house here at Kirkcaldy, upon condition that he would send for me whenever he wished to see me. The physician who saw him most frequently, Dr. Black, undertaking in the meantime to write to me occasionally an account of the state of his health. On the 22nd of August, the doctor wrote me the following letter. "Since my last, Mr. Hume has passed his time pretty easily, but is much weaker. He sits up, goes downstairs once a day, and amuses himself with reading, but seldom sees anybody. He finds that even the conversation of his most intimate friends fatigues and oppresses him, and it is happy that he does not need it, for he is quite free from anxiety, impatience, or low spirits, and passes his time very well with the assistance of amusing books. I received the day after a letter from Mr. Hume himself, of which the following is an extract. 23rd August, 1776. My dearest friend, I am obliged to make use of my nephew's hand in writing to you, as I do not rise today. I go very fast to decline, and last night had a small fever, which I hoped might put a quicker period to this tedious illness, but unluckily it has, in great measure, gone off. I cannot submit to your coming over here on my account, but Dr. Black can better inform you concerning the degree of strength which may from time to time remain with me. Adieu, etc. Three days after, I received the following letter from Dr. Black. Edinburgh, Monday, 26th August, 1776. Dear Sir, yesterday, about 4 o'clock afternoon, Mr. Hume expired. The near approach of his death became evident in the night between Thursday and Friday, when his disease became excessive and soon weakened him so much that he could no longer rise out of his bed. He continued to the last, perfectly sensible and free from much pain or feelings of distress. He never dropped the smallest expression of impatience, but when he had occasion to speak to people about him, always did it with affection and tenderness. I thought it improper to write to bring you over, especially as I had heard he had dictated a letter to you desiring you not to come. When he became very weak, it cost him an effort to speak, and he died in such a happy composure of mind that nothing could exceed it. Thus died our most excellent and never-to-be-forgotten friend, concerning whose philosophical opinions men will, no doubt, judge variously, everyone approving or condemning them according as they happen to coincide or disagree with his own, but concerning whose character and conduct there can scarce be a difference of opinion. His temper, indeed, seemed to be more happily balanced, if I may be allowed such an expression, than that perhaps of any other man I have ever known. Even in the lowest state of his fortune, his great and necessary frugality never hindered him from exercising, upon proper occasions, acts both of charity and generosity. It was a frugality founded not upon avarice, but upon the love of independency. The extreme gentleness of his nature never weakened either the firmness of his mind or the steadiness of his resolutions. His constant pleasantry was the genuine effusion of good nature and good humour, tempered with delicacy and modesty and without even the slightest tincture of malignity, so frequently the disagreeable source of what is called wit in other men. It was never the meaning of his raillery to mortify, and therefore, far from offending, it seldom failed to please and delight even those who were the objects of it. To his friends, who were frequently the objects of it, there was not perhaps any one of all his great and amiable qualities which contributed more to endear his conversation. And that gaiety of temper so agreeable in society, but which is so often accompanied with frivolous and superficial qualities, was in him certainly attended with the most severe application, the most extensive learning, the greatest depth of thought, and a capacity in every respect the most comprehensive. Upon the whole, I have always considered him both in his lifetime and since his death as approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man as perhaps the nature of human frailty will permit. I ever am, dear sir, most affectionately yours, Adam Smith.
Over the last few days, I've been able to see my life as from a great altitude, as a sort of landscape with a deepening sense of the connection of all its parts. This does not mean to say I'm finished with life. On the contrary, I feel intensely alive, and I want and hope in the time that remains to deepen my friendships, to say farewell to those I love, to write more, to travel if I have the strength, to achieve new levels of understanding and insight. This will involve audacity, clarity, and plain speaking, trying to straighten my accounts with the world. But there will be time, too, for some fun, and even some silliness as well. I feel a sudden clear focus and perspective. There is no time for anything inessential. I must focus on myself, my work, and my friends. I shall no longer look at News Hour every night. I shall no longer pay any attention to politics or arguments about global warming. This is not indifference, but detachment. I still care deeply about the Middle East, about global warming, about growing inequality. But these are no longer my business. They belong to the future. I rejoice when I meet gifted young people, even the one who biopsied and diagnosed my metastases. I feel the future is in good hands. I've been increasingly conscious for the last 10 years or so of deaths among my contemporaries. My generation is on the way out, and each death I've felt as an abruption, a tearing away of part of myself. There will be no one like us when we are gone, but then there is no one like anyone else ever. When people die, they cannot be replaced. They leave holes that cannot be filled. For it is the fate, the genetic and neural fate of every human being, to be a unique individual, to find his own path, to live his own life, to die his own death. I cannot pretend I am without fear, but my predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I've been given much and have given something in return. I have read and travelled and thought and written. I have had an intercourse with the world, the special intercourse of writers and readers. Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet. And that in itself has been an enormous privilege and adventure.
In My Own Life, Oliver Sacks was played by Joss Ackland. David Hume, Ken Stott, Adam Smith, Gordon Kennedy, and James Boswell, Robin Lane. My Own Life was produced and directed by Caroline Raphael and was a Dora production for BBC Radio 3.
And Oliver Sacks died 6 months after the publication of My Own Life. Next Sunday's drama has a very different feel. It's the groundbreaking play by Lorraine Hansberry, A Raisin in the Sun, set on Chicago's South Side in the 1950s. It revolves around the divergent dreams and conflicts within three generations of an Afro-American working-class family. It was the first play written by a black woman to be produced on Broadway, and in this radio production you'll be able to hear scenes from the original play, which were cut from the first film and stage versions and from many subsequent contemporary stage productions. A Raisin in the Sun begins on Radio 3 at the same time, 9 o'clock, next Sunday evening.
The basic commandment of tango music is don't be boring.
This week on my new series, Sound of Dance, I'll be coming face to face with tango. It's passionate, it's powerful, and it's really quite hard to dance.
The essence of tango is it's improvised. The fact that the music is so unpredictable is why tango is so exciting.
Join me, Katie Derham, as I delve into the history and performance of tango, the dance from Argentina that became a global phenomenon. Sound of Dance, next Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Stephen Isserlis and Robert Levin play Beethoven in about an hour's time. That's at 5 to 11. Before that, we join Aileen Manahan-Thomas for Early Music Late.
Hello and welcome to a concert of the best of the Baroque. The Frankfurt Radio Symphony, under the direction of Maurice Steger, brings us music by Purcell, Sammartini, Handel and Vivaldi in this recital performed at the Frankfurt Hessischer Rundfunk in November last year. They open our programme with a suite from King Arthur, Purcell's semi-opera from 1691, with libretto by John Dryden. Based on the battles between Arthur's Britons and the Saxons, it was a spectacular restoration piece, with appearances by Merlin, Cupid and Venus, and even the Germanic gods Woden, Thor and Freya. Much of the text is spoken, and Purcell's music punctuates the more dramatic moments, as well as being incidental. Here is an instrumental suite.